Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Slow Burn Media and Bill Huffman present a very special episode of Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic, featuring Nick and the captain of the True Crime Garage podcast.
Amy was last seen at the Bay Village Square shopping plaza, a popular after-school hangout for kids. She reportedly told classmates it was here that she was to meet a family friend who would take her on a shopping spree.
Amy's body was found in Ashland County near the Huron County line. That's well to the southwest of the community of Bay Village.
No, we have no new developments since yesterday. We conducted searches today. We had four dogs, a helicopter, approximately 40 police officers and various law enforcement officers from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We had four of our police fire divers out today checking bodies of water in the area, and we have come up with nothing.
Out there, the victim was a male, 11 years old. He was abducted by an individual wearing a ski mask and who had a gun. Here, of course, Amy's abduction was accomplished as a part of a ruse.
Their goal was to be prepared and to just get the students through this day. Well, they did it, and they'll do it again tomorrow and the next day, until the students accept and understand Amy's tragic departure from their lives, and until they can continue on with their own. In Bay Village, I'm Barbara Serrano reporting for the 10 o'clock news.
This whole thing had to be a tremendous shock for the entire family.
It was. It's terrible. It's something that just couldn't heal. Hopefully now it will.
Within 30 miles of the abduction site is usually where the victim is found, either alive or dead.
Mother came home from work that evening. Her son told her Amy wasn't home yet.
And then the next thing he said, I passed her bicycle in the rack at school at 4:30.
And the FBI's William Brannon says he may still be in the area, carefully watching the investigation. And the best way to recognize him is a change of character. Brannon says the kidnapper may have become anxious, lost sleep or weight, and may drink heavily or turn to drugs.
Caution was the byword today as police routinely patrolled the school grounds in search of anything out of the ordinary.
And the FBI's William Brannon says he may still be in the area, carefully watching the investigation. And the best way to recognize him is a change of character. Brannon says the kidnapper may have become anxious, lost sleep or weight, and may drink heavily or turn to drugs.
First couple of 4 or 5 days, you know, you spend 24 hours a day crying your eyes out and saying, why me, why my Amy? And I guess there is no answer to that question, because this is proven it can happen anywhere, anytime. But after a while, you still cry.
Police describe the man as white, in his early 30s, about 5'9", of medium build, with dark hair, a bald spot in the back, and round glasses. One of Amy's friends reportedly told police that Amy said she was to meet someone who claimed to be a friend of the family to go buy her mother a surprise gift. Amy was last seen on Friday afternoon at this Bay Village shopping center. It's right across the street from the police department. She had gone into Baskin-Robbins for some ice cream with her friends, and then later was seen talking with a man.
Amy's abductor has been described as a white male, 35 to 45 years old, approximately 5'8", and wearing glasses.
Slow Burn Media and Bill Huffman present Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic? This week featuring Nick and the Captain from the True Crime Garage podcast. And as you guys know, I have covered this case extensively since 2018. I've spoken with her father, I've spoken with the chief of police, I've spoken with the special agent in charge, spoken with some of her friends, as well as a lot of reporters and journalists that have been involved with her case. Nick and the Captain are two of my favorite podcasters in the true crime genre, and they have covered Amy's case, I think, about 8 times in the 400 and some episodes that they have done. So they're very reliable sources. They're out of Columbus. They remember the incident as children, just like we all do. And again, I love having them on the show. This is the first time that we were able to discuss the case together. So I hope you guys enjoy this week's very special episode. As you know, October 27th will mark the 31-year anniversary since Amy was abducted. This case still remains unsolved, and all tips should be contacted to the Bay Village Police Department at 440-871-1234 or via the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. And again, the Bay Village community is placing posters on telephone poles this year. It's a case that is not gone from the community, and it is definitely something that is ripe for resolution and for the hope of the city and for the family involved. And again, knowing Mark and Georgette and the people that are impacted directly through this case, I just hope that there will be a resolution sooner rather than later. So again, join me this week as we discuss who killed Amy Mihaljevic. I am lucky to have Nick and the Captain on this week's episode of Who Killed to discuss who killed Amy Mihaljevic. And welcome to the show, guys.
Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you know, I've never had the both of you on at the same time. It's quite a treat, and I hope the listeners will enjoy that as well, because I know you guys both have opinions on this case. And we're coming on 31 years of this case being unsolved. And just give me a little background on each of your involvement with the case, because I know that to some degree it's a passion case of yours, but it's not, you know, you didn't grow up in the Cleveland area, but age-wise, and, you know, you've done a lot of episodes about it. So I just wanted to hear what you guys thought about the case, and having you both together, it's pretty nice.
Well, my involvement in the case probably stems from Nick's passion for it. I think it's a case that he's looked into several times. A lot of the cases we cover on the show, we have 7 days to dissect them as much as we can, and then we have to move on to the next case. With Amy's case, because there's so much information out there, it's a case that you can keep going back to over and over, and we've done that several times with our show. So I think my passion for the case comes from, it's something that he's interested in talking about, so anything that he brings to my attention, then I'm up late night, you know, up late night Googling whatever he brought to my attention. So that's how I got involved in it.
Well, I've followed the case for a few years, and it's, you know, it's led me to some interesting characters. Bill, you're one of them. And, you know, now a friend. And of course, James Renner, who wrote the book, Searching for Amy, My Hunt for Her Killer. Yeah, it's an interesting case. We're all, the Captain, me, you, we're all about Amy's age. We're all from Ohio. We all can identify with that. I've told you before on this show, it was really, for me, it was a point in my life where a crime story that I saw on TV became something that was real. It wasn't just a story. It wasn't just happening to people that live far away in some place that I'd never been to. It wasn't something, a segment on Unsolved Mysteries. This was a person that was my age that was, you know, experiencing roughly the same things I was at the time, and lived a couple, you know, an hour or two up the road from me. And it became very real. And I remember when they found her, and that made it even more real, because when she was missing, I was little at the time. you don't expect for the worst to happen, and it did. And it's a case that I followed for a very long time. And now here we are, as you pointed out, we are days away from the 31st anniversary of when she was abducted. And it's weird because the connections that I've made with people throughout the years looking into this case so much, they're all kind of reaching out to me again. Everybody's kind of talking again. It's on everyone's mind this time of year, of course.
I was going to say, it's also really interesting since we started the podcast. Before we started the podcast, Nick gives me a call one day and says, I'm going to this book reading of this author about this case, happened to be James Renner. You know, cut to a year later, James is on the show. Then we end up having a relationship with James. Then you start your podcast. Then we have a relationship with you. And just this week, my buddy comes to visit to, you know, hey, this girl that listens to your podcast, we struck up a conversation. We've been dating. We're now getting married. They come to my house, you know, so I can meet her and everything. And then she explains to me that she's was a longtime friend of Amy Mahalovic's. So it's just crazy how, even though it's 2 hours away, how connected we have become with a case like this.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It does sort of connect a lot of different. It comes up in a lot of different scenarios. A lot of, I'll be randomly out and talking about something, and somebody will come up to me and be like, "Oh, I heard you're the one that did the Amy Mahalovic podcast. I went to school with her," or, you know, it is something that I think as Ohioans or just like the people in our generation, it's just something that is always going to be. Until it's solved, I think, and if it's solved, I think it's going to be one of those things that will constantly come up in conversation if we're discussing true crime or things that affected us as kids. Because like Nick said, you know, it was the first time that a real crime affected the way that he looked at life. You know, it was like, wait a second, this could actually come to my doorstep, and it's not just something that I see on TV or hear about. And I think that is probably, for me, I know that's probably the reason for me that it's resonated so long, and that it was just like somebody that could have easily been a part of my group of friends that was just, you know, like, how do you know that somebody that you know is getting a phone call from a stranger? And what do you even say if you do know that? It's just, the whole situation, I think, is so unique. And I think that's what kind of traumatizes a little bit of everybody. And I know for me.
Well, it's a very unique situation to have anybody in your elementary school pass away. And so to have a situation where this person obviously passed away, but it wasn't, you know, that she ended up having cancer or something. This was somebody that was taken from this earth. So I think it's, especially the people that went to school with her or knew her in that community, how much that had to affect their childhood, probably even 10 times more than our childhood, just hearing about it from a distance.
Well, and yeah, you know, stranger child abduction is, thank God, a very rare thing. But in 1989, you have Jacob Wetterling is abducted at gunpoint. You know, him and his buddies are on bikes coming from the video store.
That case is honestly, that was between your show and In the Dark. You guys were those were the driving forces behind doing a podcast about Amy Mahalovic, because Wetterling was literally our age. And I mean, so was Amy, but right. We all rode bikes. We were guys. Come on, you know, like if we were with two buddies, why wouldn't you think you'd be safe? And then 4 days later, whatever it was, Amy's abducted. And I think in the Redux episode that I'm doing tomorrow, or will have been last week, but basically that was a national story, where Amy's story was a national story, but it didn't
take off the way that Jacob's took off.
Yeah.
And I think the big part of that is, one, we have two witnesses, direct witnesses in his case, that say this is what happened. And the story itself of what happened is so terrifying. And then with Amy's, it doesn't even become really local news. I know that it hit the news that night because they're looking for her, but it didn't really become local news of an abduction until a couple days later. And that was with the story leaking out about, oh, I'm meeting an unknown man that's a family friend, in air quotes, that I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I'm meeting them at this shopping plaza. And I think those two things, though, compounded together, are just very extreme for any community. And like you said, Jacob's case national, Amy's case quickly becomes a big regional story. And those two things together, I think, are going to be forever imprinted in people's minds that are of our age, you know, people that are in their mid-30s to mid-40s. It was a big time, and Wetterling's case went unsolved for so many years. I mean, think about the story of his abduction. The three of them coming back from the video store. This vehicle pulls up. A lone man gets out with a gun. Two of these witnesses are going to go home, and they're going to tell their parents, we didn't get a good look at the guy, but what we did see, we do not know who this man is. And he tells them to lay down
right
in the field, face down, so they can't get that good of a look at him. And he asks them their ages. How old are you? Each one of them has to shout out their age. He walks up to each one of them, picks them up, looks them in the face. Who knows what he's looking for? And he decides which of the three to take, like he's freaking grocery shopping. And he drives off with this kid, and we never see him again. And it's almost 30 years later to get some answers in that case. Amy's case, just as bizarre. But this was not a man with a gun, with witnesses that saw and identified and knew right away what was going on. This was evil came in through the locked door of their home via the telephone,
mm-hmm.
and tricked this smart little girl into meeting him, and he just so casually walked away with her in front of everybody.
Yeah. I mean, and in that sense, do you feel like the killer is a local? I mean, if Wetterling's case, the guy, Danny Heinrich, who was eventually convicted of it, was basically a known pervert, but nobody really connected the dots between what he had done in a previous city and basically he went like 30 minutes out of his way to go and kidnap Wetterling. With Amy's case, you know, with the fact that she was found in Ashland, which is an hour from where she was last seen, and the familiarity with the locale of Bay Village, you know, Nick, you mentioned he was like going grocery shopping by picking up the children and looking at them and asking their ages. It's, you know, if all the other phone calls are correct, like that they were actually connected to the same individual, in a sense he was doing the same thing, but like you said, sneaking in through the people, you know, with the telephone. And that's the way he was getting into the house, opposed to showing up with a gun and saying, come with me, kid, YouTube run in the woods. You know, that's, and I think, honestly, I do believe if Jacob's story did not happen, Amy's story would have gotten more coverage.
Right. And the weird thing about it, too, was in the minds of parents and in the minds of the people in the communities, immediately you go, well, this is such a rarity. This, they have to be somehow connected. And I was, you know, there's an old newspaper article, I think it was from the Akron Beacon Journal, where they're straight up, local law enforcement in Amy's case is straight up asked, is there any connection between this case here in Minnesota, the Jacob Wetterling case that just happened 4 or 5 days ago, and then Amy Mihaljevic? They're almost the same age. And You know, I've heard people's comments on at a certain age, gender doesn't matter to these creeps, and I get that, but I think from what I've seen and experienced as far as true crime goes, and cases that we've covered, and cases that I've looked into, these two were older enough that I think gender did matter. And I think law enforcement is not only aware of that, but they were vocal about that at the time, because they straight up said, well, you do have to consider the fact that the victims here are male. One is male and one is female. Yes, they're about the same age, but one haunting thing that the investigator said in that same article, he says, but if you look at the two of them, they could be brother and sister. And it's just, and it's weird how in some strange, bizarre, scary, creepy way, they're kind of linked in some way forever, 30 years later.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you guys believe that the phone calls are connected?
I debate that. I think maybe a couple of them may be connected. I don't know if, I think there was a report of 8 phone calls, but I mean, when I spoke with Chief Spetzel, I think he's confirmed maybe 2 were connected. So that leaves 6 out there that, I don't know. I mean, it's the 80s, and even today, people like to be a part of the story. So I'm not sure if I can take everything with a, you know, as it is. I tend to take that with a grain of salt. How about you, Nick?
Well, I think that this is something that we won't know for certain until the case is solved, because you have to factor in a few things into the equation. One, how targeted was Amy specifically? If she was the target all along, then if there were any phone calls connected to this, this was just somebody trying out and practicing to, you know, hone their craft a bit before they go to their target. So those are really calls that, yeah, they're connected, but they don't serve the same purpose for our perpetrator. Now, I'm with you, Bill. There's been, over the years, I've heard 8, 9, numbers as high as 12. If you go back to the initial investigation in 89 and 90, what they were saying at that time was that there was probably 2 that they seemed to think were actually, in fact, connected. My guess all along with that was that there must have been some verbiage in those conversations that were similar enough to the unknown. We got to keep that in mind. We don't know the exact conversation that went down between Amy and this guy, but there must have been something in there enough for police to say on the record, we think that these two could be possibly connected. Now, as far as I could trace that back, it actually appears that the two that they think are most likely connected to Amy's case were calls that took place in March and April. Amy's not getting these calls. We have no reason to believe that she got these calls until a day or days or a week before she was actually abducted, which was late October. That's a pretty big window. So if in fact they are connected and they're not the same neighborhood, they're not the same city, they're not the same town, we have to ask ourselves, why is that? Why is that window so big? If they are in fact connected, what's going on between April and October that prevents this guy from continuing to do this? Did he get scared?
Or maybe he did continue and they just weren't reported.
Correct. And that's the thing that I think Bill points out very well. This was the 80s. Crank calls were a thing. They weren't that terribly uncommon. And with Amy's case, the other thing too is maybe they didn't hit their mark. You know, maybe Big Brother was home and picked up the phone. Maybe, you know, that stuff we will never know. But I actually, the more and more that I look at this case, the more that I think that Amy was targeted. I just don't know how, you know, sometimes these perverts will cast a wide net. We don't know how many he was going after or what, but I do think she was targeted. And I'm with the captain. I think that if these two were connected, there's probably other calls that we just don't know about. That's a long answer to say, I don't know, Bill.
Yeah, my gut feeling is actually less, that maybe there's not even one other call connected, that they might have, like you said, a singular call that they go, well, this is a possibility, but not 100%, you know, connection there. And that's a gut feeling, but it's also based off of Amy's look, her age, her attitude, things that she was involved in. I don't think she was the typical girl next door or even the quote unquote all American girl. So I think that her look and her demeanor were that did something to this individual to make him want to target her.
Well, I would say this about Amy, and this kind of goes back to Nick's discussion about gender not mattering at a certain age. Amy was an older 10-year-old. She wasn't, I mean, she was a, I mean, girls develop before boys. That's as any male knows, you know, you go to a junior high dance, the girl's taller than you are. It, or at least it was for me. I don't know. But anyway,
I had a beard in sixth grade.
So. Why does that not surprise me? I'm just not surprised.
It was a little strange, but we got through it.
He had been held back 4 or 5 years.
Maybe six. I couldn't count at the time, so I'm not for sure.
All making sense now. Yeah. All makes sense. Yes, I think Amy was targeted. I think that, you know, with her look, like the captain said, with her look, and if you're, like, let's say you're basing it off of the picture that they use on the school poster, or not the school poster, but the missing poster, that picture, you know, Renner always talks about how she hated that picture, because in all reality, she was more of like a tomboy. And
Yeah. Right. She
was more into being at the farm, you know, because she rode horses and that type of stuff, opposed to playing Barbies or whatever. Not to say that she didn't, just wasn't necessarily number one on her list. So I definitely think that the appeal,
but here's the thing, though, is like, you know, when you think of your buddies going on dates. Right. And I know that's a whole different thing, but most people, you know, have types. So why wouldn't a pedophile have a type? It's just, you know, and that's where my argument with a lot of these missing.
They do 100%. Yeah. Right? And whoever did this to Amy did. And she unfortunately fit his type.
Right. And I think that to me matters, because I do think there are molesters and pedophiles out there that they'll just take whatever they can get. Just like you have a friend that will just go on any date he can go on, you know, because that's where he's placed his self-esteem, his confidence, or whatever. And I
unfortunately all know somebody like that.
Yeah. And it's and I've been I thought a lot about that with like Brian Schaefer's case. If it was a possible abduction, that if there are people out there going after a 10-year-old girl, going after a 15-year-old girl, going after a 20-year-old girl, having types of victims, then why isn't there somebody out there that's going, hey, I'm looking for a mid-20-year-old good-looking man? And that's my victim type, you know. But I think because she was a tomboy, I think that's where, to me, that's the proof that it was more targeted.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
That was always one of my things growing up. I played sports. So who was I around? The guys that played sports with me. And when we're at this soccer tournament, guess who we're hanging out with? The girls team. And because there were athletes, a lot of them were more tomboyish. So that's always been a type of mine. So the sporty type. But I have a lot of friends that are not into that at all. They don't get it. But why would you want a girl that's good at sports? You know, like, how is that attractive to you? So I think because of that, I just think it puts a smaller a frame on what type of individual we're looking for.
But see, I think therein lies something that I've said from Jump Street. All along, I've always said, if you could figure out how this individual knows Amy and she does not know him, that's your link to finding this killer. It always has been, and in my opinion, it always will. And we're talking about victimology here. And if this pedo has a type, well, what type is it? Because with Amy, look, I've been looking at this thing a long time. Amy could fall into three different types depending on what day of the week it is.
Right.
She was very often, yes, a tomboy. Mm-hmm. And the videos that we see, her father says that she was. You know, that is no mystery. That is a truth. However, her school pictures, she looks like the cute, done-up girl that the boys would want to talk to. A completely different type. And then we also have neighborhood friends, parents of close friends of hers, that she was a ragamuffin. She was someone that was a child that was maybe not taken care of as good as she could have been because Margaret had her issues. She was, and sometimes that's a type for a lot of these predators as well. I mean, David Elliott Penton, he killed multiple little girls that were 5, 6, 7 years old. You know who he targeted? The ones that he thought were throwaways, the ones that he thought nobody would miss, the ones that lived in poverty, the ones that he thought, you know what, the police won't care about them, or yeah, mom's got a drug problem, so they'll start looking at the family before they look at the strange guy that creeped up next to this kid in the van that I've been following around for a week. So there are different types, and I think that Amy's victimology is difficult, one, because of her age. And Bill, you're absolutely right. She does appear to be older. You know, she, in a lot of the pictures and videos leading up to her abduction, she actually appears to me to be like 12, 12 and a half years old. So it goes back to victimology. Victimology is so important in finding and really shrinking the pool of people, the suspect pool that you're going to choose from. So,
yeah, and I'd say the ragamuffin thing, though, is also indicative of a tomboy. Was it that she wasn't kempt because of her parents, or was she not kempt because when they tried to keep her that way, it was a disaster? You know, it's like I have nephews that will go outside in their nicest clothes and come back covered in mud. Eventually, you don't put them in their nicest clothes. Oh, you're going to go outside and play? Throw on this.
Yeah, just to give Amy's family a little bit of there was that was one thing that they were not pleased about, was the description of her being a ragamuffin, which any family would, you know, it's got a negative connotation to it in some ways. Some people take it as, oh, she wasn't taken care of. But like the captain said, it's more like, no, she probably just put on whatever the hell she wanted to put on and went and did her own thing. It wasn't so much of a, you know, she's not being taken care of. I mean, her dad had a good job. Her mom had a good job. I mean, they weren't, trust me, the neighborhood they lived in was far from impoverished. And, you know, it's one of those things, like with Margaret having known issues. I mean, this is not a shocker. We're not like speaking out of school. You know, she drank, she had addiction issues with alcohol. And with that being said, I mean, do you feel like, and I think Renner's brought this up, do you feel like that this person could have been in her circle of friends, or within her, maybe not circle of friends, but within the people that she hung out with?
Well, I mean, you guys know the case better than me, but it's pretty common knowledge that a lot of people believe that she was taken from the shopping plaza. And then there's a debate on how long she was alive afterwards, but they believe that she was taken away from that area. And like you were saying, how she has a little bit of an older demeanor. I almost feel like this individual had to know her enough to know little quirks about her. But I think their idea was that they're going to have some kind of real relationship with her. And then at some point, the perpetrator's going, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense. This is not going to end well for me, her, or anybody. And I believe she was murdered because of that. Because they realized they made a mistake, and they can't just drive her back home and drop her off. That whether she knew the individual or he just felt like the time they spent together, she knew her enough at that point, knew them enough at that point. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people, again, that argue back and forth on if this was the first time for this individual or multiple times, or if they tried to have other victims later. And maybe it's just a gut feeling, but I think this was such a mistake that they made. That's why the murder happened, and that's probably why there was never another one connected to her case. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, and I do want to kind of clarify what I was talking about before, because I don't think that I hit it home all the way. But the ragamuffin not cared for, that the stuff that I was saying, look, there's no doubt about it. She came from a good family, came from a good neighborhood, lived in a great area, wonderful house, went to a good school. Nobody questions that. And Mark Mihaljevic is a hell of a guy, and the Mihaljevic family has been through hell. What I'm trying to point out is what is the perception of the abductor. It doesn't have to be the actual reality of what's going right on. But when we have other people who have referred to her as a ragamuffin, you referenced somebody, Bill, but you know, also we have Jeannie Sabo and others. It, you know, and I think that was meant to be, I'm not going to go too far down a weird rabbit hole here, but I think that was meant to be a term of endearment. But we also know what the definition of that word actually is. And so what I'm pointing out here is if this guy was keeping watch on a neighborhood or looking for a victim, because he was looking for a victim. That's one thing we know without knowing who he is or his modus operandi. We know that for a fact.
Whether it was a relationship or whatever.
Right. And what I'm pointing out here is it wouldn't take much for someone to think that maybe she falls into this category of somebody that's vulnerable, and that maybe he's looking for somebody that's vulnerable. Right. It wouldn't take much to notice that a couple days a week, she's riding her bike by herself down to Holly Hills. Oh, there's no parent around. Oh, every time I see her, she's in sweatpants off by herself. You know what I mean? It's the perception of the abductor that she could fall into his quote unquote type victimology that he's looking for. But again, it not be the full reality. And you asked if I think that it's somebody that she knew. No, I've always said this, that I think that the main perpetrator, I want to underline that word real quick without staying on it too long. The main perpetrator in this whole ordeal, she did not know who he was. That doesn't mean that the Mihaljevic family doesn't know him. It doesn't mean that someone in her bigger, larger circle does not know this guy. I don't think she knew him. I think Amy was a very intelligent girl. There's plenty of evidence to back that up. And what she was told on the phone, as far as we know, she did not know who this guy was. She was smart enough that if she would have recognized him that day when he met her, she would have went, this is not on the up and up. There's something wrong here. And we wouldn't be sitting here talking about the death and murder of Amy Mihaljevic 31 years later.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that one. I think that both of you guys are right in the sense that if things would have gone differently, if she wouldn't have put up a fight, most likely, I mean, we know that she, we're pretty sure she did. You know, she was not going to back down, but to say that, I mean, man, if things could have gone differently, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it. It's a crazy thought. And I know this is a controversial, and this is, I don't even know if anybody's even talked about this, but, and I know I've talked to Chief Spetzel and he's given me specifics on the phone call and stuff like that. And earlier we talked about the phone calls being connected. What if the phone call didn't even happen? And this is like, she's, I don't know. I mean, it just seems like that's the only narrative that we've been given since the beginning. And
true, but we've been, you know, that information comes from more than one source.
Comes from two sources.
Correct. And two people that she told.
Right. And it's,
and to me, it seems like too much of a coincidence.
I agree. I agree. I'm posing a question. I'm not necessarily right. saying that it is at all. I just think that when you follow one narrative for 31 years and you haven't seen any results from that particular course, you start to, you have to at least question for a second whether or not there's something amiss. And it's not to say that there wasn't a phone call or there wasn't this, that, but like, we know the game of telephone, things get misconstrued by the second person, third person, whomever, you know, it's a different story by the end. And I'm just bringing it up as a question because of the fact that that's the only story we've ever been given.
We were actually somewhat talking about this while we were recording this week, because I've been talking to a lot of people involved in different cases, and you have this narrative, especially like in Amy's case, it's 31 years. So there's all these things that we now view as factual. And most of that comes from published items. And when I mean published items, you know, through podcasting, Bill, that normally when you go to post your new episode, it normally says publish the new episode. And so whether it's through books, whether it's through TV shows, whether it's through podcast, sometimes we are rewriting the narrative of some of these cases. And that makes it harder to solve, because go back to the Golden State Killer case. When my friend showed me that a year and a half before the cops arrested this individual, that there was a guy on the message board going, hey, by the way, I've been looking into my family's history, and my dad used to break into houses, and he used to have this guy that would help him out sometimes. And here's a picture of the guy. And then on the message board, it's all these so-called experts of the case going, you don't know anything about the case. You're not an expert. You're stupid. You know, what's the guy's name? Oh, well, the guy gave me a pot, or gave my dad a pot at one point. It had his last name. You know, after being called an idiot, after people telling him, go read this book and research the case, the guy goes, oh, here's his name. And then a year and a half later, after DNA tests are done, the guy's arrested and charged as a Golden State Killer. But he was on a forum a year and a half earlier looking for some answers. And I think that's where we're at with a lot of these cases. Amy Mihaljevic, Mara Murray, Brian Schaefer, that podcasters, authors, documentarians, they're rewriting the narrative of what is factual. And then what's crazy to me, just this last week, I'm interviewing the boyfriend of a missing girl. He's going over some of the stuff that happened in the initial search. And he tells me a couple pieces of information that I never heard before. And then don't really believe him. Can you confirm this? Oh, yeah. This guy was with me. This guy was with me. So I talked to them. Now I got three people telling me the same story. I didn't even ask him a question. I just said, can you go over the story? Can you tell me from your... They tell me the same information. I go to an author that wrote about the case. He's telling me, no, that's a lie. That's not true. You can't believe him. Go to all these other individuals that have studied the case. Oh, he must be lying. So you're going to tell me that you wrote a book about the case, so you now know more than three individuals that were actually in her room? You see what I'm saying? Like, or were actually there at the search? We need to go back with a lot of these cases and try not to rewrite the history of it. Perfect example, like in the Mara Murray case, we have an eyewitness at the crash scene, one of the neighbors, that said they saw a man possibly smoking in the passenger seat. And later on, years later, the internet determines that that wasn't a cigarette, that it was possibly a light from a cell phone. Possibly a light from a cell phone. And now people are going back and looking into that case going, wait a second. We can't just turn this eyewitness's statements into whatever the hell we want it to be. And every time I've brought up that case to detectives, to police officers, they always tell me the most important thing in that case is the crash, what happened within the next 30 minutes or so. And when I go over the eyewitness that saw the smoker, they go, oh, that, well, that's important. And then I say to them, well, we think it might have been a cell phone. They go, we don't care what you think it is. What did the eyewitness tell you? And maybe the eyewitness was wrong, but you can't rewrite the narrative. And I think we've done that a lot in cases because, for example, the Amy case becomes more interesting because she got a phone call. Because she got duped. Okay, now, if that phone call was real and that phone call happened another 12 times, oh, shit, that's fascinating. Same way with, like, the Brian Schaefer case. We have no footage of him leaving the bar. Right there, you're hooked. Guy walks into a bar. We have no footage of him leaving. He's never been seen again. And we can't just rewrite the narrative that we want it to be. And I think a lot of times, even like in a case like this, and I think maybe it's a Hollywood thing too as well. We think that there's some genius Hannibal Lecter out there that's creating murders like Seven, you know, going through the seven deadly sins or whatever.
I just watched that again the other day. Great movie.
Yeah, it's an amazing movie, but that's normally not
real. It's a movie.
Yeah, normally it's not reality. Chances are this guy was very lonely. He felt this weird connection. He built a relationship between her and him in his head that didn't exist in real life. And he then got his opportunity. And I wouldn't even say I would say he's average or below average IQ. And yeah, I think people think that there's some like mastermind out there. And after he was able to kill Amy, that he was going to then keep repeating it. Well, if he was a mastermind, there wouldn't be 12 calls with no captures. There would have been 10 calls and 8 captures or whatever. But I think because we can't connect her case to anybody else's case, I think that proves as it was a one-off, then that goes to, well, why would it be a one killing for this individual? I went on a complete crazy rant. Sorry about that. But it's just, I just been noticing this a lot as we cover cases.
It's a great point. It really is. I mean, and that, and what, like what you said about the genius Hannibal Lecter types, and I mean, look at Joseph D'Angelo or whatever the Golden State Killer's name is. You look at that guy, and you know, he's far from Hannibal Lecter, you know, intellectually, and sure, he was just more lucky, I think, than anything. And in a lot of cases, I mean, he obviously was smart enough to get away with it, but I do believe that this is a most likely a one-off. But
I also think because his plan got derailed, and I think that's why there was a murder, that we have to view this individual as somebody with a background that didn't do a lot of planning with their own life. And that would go back to like maybe where he lives. That I think that's also indicative of how much financial means he had, because this person was not a planner. Like, yeah, he made a phone call and got her to go to the shopping plaza, but I think that's, I don't think he had much of a plan after that. And I think this individual was shocked that that even worked. And since he didn't have much of a plan, I even think as far as like dumping the body, why wouldn't you, you're talking about an area that's pretty wide open. You could have just went a little bit further and dug a ditch, and more likely that she wouldn't have been found. So I think there's a lot of missteps planning wise. And I think then that goes into the psychology of the individual, not, you know, a little below average IQ, doesn't plan a lot with their life, probably doesn't have a lot of possessions, probably doesn't have a lot of money in the bank, probably isn't that far along in any type of career, because they're not one to plan.
Yeah, Nick, what's your feelings on that?
Look, I mean, obviously we clearly don't know the personality of this individual. I see somebody who took a lot of efforts and planned a lot of things, and actually, whether it was luck or intelligence, or both, I see that there in the abduction of this kid. And I think that
but hold on, and not to, I'm not trying to sass you or anything, but what are the things that he planned out? The phone call on the meetup and then taking her away from that location?
Yes.
But it wasn't a plan not to be seen.
Yes, it was. That I think is important to the makeup of this individual. The phone call shows to me someone a little more patient and maybe even a little more practiced, even if it's just thought and in planning, because you grab a kid at random on the side of the road, there's very often witnesses. And what we have, yes, of course, we do have witnesses in this exact story, but we have two very different kinds of witnesses. And when you compare the two, when you see a screaming kid get pulled into a car, that's a completely different witness than someone telling you a couple right. days later, oh, I saw this man who was in his 30 to 35 years of age. He walked up to Amy and the two walked away together. I think there's little nuances in here to me. And yes, I'm filling in a lot of blanks. I'm not going to lie about that. I'm filling in a lot of blanks that we simply do not know the answers to. And yes, I'm making probably some leaps along the way too. So take this with a grain of salt, but everything that I see here and the blanks that I'm choosing the way to fill them in, I see someone who has planned this out. We don't have the problem, and this is something that the chief of police was screaming from the hilltop immediately, was we do not have a description of a vehicle. He's like, I would trade everything right. in this case for a description of a vehicle. I think that shows some level of criminal sophistication here. I think that very likely, and I'm not going to say that Dean Runkle did this, but, and I don't, you know, he's certainly on my list of suspects, but I think that James and others have something there with the thought that this guy very likely parked behind the plaza. He didn't park in the parking lot that is so visible from every storefront in that plaza. We right. don't have anybody saying, oh, I saw the two of them leave in this vehicle, this, you know, whatever it may be. I think that shows a level of criminal sophistication. The other thing too, that, you know, there's that weird comment by that's in the papers and always has been. And who knows, again, Captain's right. Who knows if somebody's changed the narrative? I don't know. But this was from the beginning where a witness said, I saw him place his hand on her back and he led her away. Think about that action and what that requires. Why would you do that? Everything is a choice, whether it's he did something subconsciously or he did it well and it with planned thought. Putting your hand on the back of a child and quietly walking them away is so much better than going, you see that blue truck over there? That's mine. That's where we're heading. You have to instruct this child where to go with you. You know, it's a
very gentle gesture,
right?
Putting your hand on her shoulder. You're not grabbing her arm. You're not even trying to hold her hand.
We don't have anybody saying that I saw them leave in this vehicle. We don't have a vehicle description. And then to take that a step further, we don't have anybody going, oh, he motioned toward a vehicle. We saw them walking toward this vehicle because there wasn't a ton.
Oh, hold on. Right. But what I'm saying is I agree with you on that. But what I'm saying is you could plan the call. You can plan the place to meet. You could plan, this is where I'll park and I'll take her to my vehicle. I don't think there was a lot thought out after that.
Well, we have the phone call to Margaret, which I think is another strategic thing that was done. We know that there's a third location. You know, this is one of those crimes where we have multiple crime scenes when you really break it down. We have her home where the phone calls took place. We have the shopping mall, the shopping plaza where she was abducted from. We have the perpetrator's vehicle. Right. We know that there's a vehicle involved because he transported her alive, dead, what have you. But there's a third place. I have a hard time believing that she was killed in a vehicle and then just dumped on the side of the road in Ashland County. And so right. there's another crime scene that we are unaware of. So again, it's yes, you're on the surface, you're absolutely right. I'm not disagreeing with you, but what I'm saying is when you have to really break it down and start going, okay, well, yeah, not only did he do the phone calls, but there's things inside the phone calls that are smart too. She told people about the phone calls. She doesn't name the person.
Right.
Well, that's pretty clever. He gained her trust by telling her things about her and her life. That's pretty intelligent. And I'm not trying to give this, you know, despicable person any type of credit. I'm just saying that it's a combination of he got some things right and he probably got lucky on a few things too. But I see somebody that was able to basically undetected abduct a pretty smart child in broad daylight in a very safe area. And he took precautions to buy some time afterward. Phone call to Margaret and I see what you're saying. Well,
I'm not saying this guy's a moron.
The murder doesn't seem to be thought out, nor does the dumping of the body, but those things are all secondary because neither of those, we're all saying that we don't think that was the intention. If that's not the intention, there's no way of planning for something that you don't foresee happening.
Right. But here's my analogy. Guy goes to school, honor roll, ABC student. You should go to college. Well, I don't know what I want to do with my life, so I'll go to college. Halfway through college, what's your major? I don't know. I'm just here taking classes. At some point, well, you got a bunch of credits that lead you to be an English teacher, let's say. Okay, well, I'll do that. Get done with school. Can't get a job as a teacher, so then you get a job as something else. That's what I'm saying about as far as the sophistication that I think the person had. I think they had, obviously, they had this idea that I'm going to make this call. I'm going to try to meet her here. I'm going to, you know, park in the back or whatever. But I think if there was a plan, there was a broad plan, but at some point it went off the rails and there was no, I think if there was a higher level of sophistication, there would have been, well, if this happens, then here's my options. If this happens, here's my options. And I just don't think this person had all that stuff planned out, if that makes any sense at all.
No, it does. It makes sense. I hear both sides of the coin on you guys' perspectives. A little bit about the plaza. It's like a U-shaped plaza. There's actually a number of places this individual could have parked that would have been outside of the view of the general public. I mean, you could park right behind any of the stores. I mean, one of the grocery stores is the closest thing, and it's just the back of the grocery store. So, you know, there was a bank on the one side that wasn't really occupied by anybody other than an ATM. I don't even know if the ATM was there at the time, but I can assure you that there were plenty of places that this individual could have led her out of the public sight. But the one thing that is interesting about that is we don't have any description of them going around the corner. All we have is that last bit of information about him putting his hand on her back and leading her, but nobody says where, or this was the last time, you know, like, again, the witnesses were kids, so I don't think they kept their eyes on them. But
right, but here's my problem with the level of sophistication is, when, great point. Well, he didn't obviously park where his vehicle was likely to be seen, but he is leading her to a place that he's going to be seen.
I think he's in disguise, to be 100% honest with you. I mean, I mean, look at the sketch. It just looks like a wig and glasses. If that's
or combed forward in glasses,
yeah. And I just feel like, you know,
because I think the level of sophistication would come in. Okay, I can convince you that we're going to go to this plaza. Well, 15, 20 minutes after school's let out, it's a desert. Why wouldn't you just go, I'll meet you at your school right after? You know, or I'll meet you around the corner from the school.
Teachers, parents.
Well, I get the teachers. And also, if somebody's in there waiting and they're by themselves, the teacher's going to go, Amy, who are you waiting for? Oh, this guy is supposed to come pick me up. But I'm just saying that there's all these other places that you could have said, well, meet me here so then we can go to the plaza.
Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have for this week's episode. But stay tuned for part two next week with Nick and the Captain of True Crime Garage. Thank you so much to Nick and the Captain for joining me on this very special episode of Who Killed Amy Mahalovic. October 27th marks the 31st anniversary of Amy's abduction from the Bay Village Plaza, and her case remains unsolved to this day. If you guys have any information in regards to the death of Amy Renee Mahalovic, I implore you to contact the Bay Village Police Department at 440-871-1234, or you can contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. And again, if you have any information and want to stay anonymous, you can also submit a tip via Crime Stoppers. If you do enjoy the podcasts that I do produce, you can help support the show by donating via PayPal with my username BillHuffman123@yahoo.com, or via Venmo with my username Bill-Huffman-3, and that will help keep these shows on the air. So again, any contribution does help, and if you want to support the show via a review, that would be great too, because that helps keep the cases that I cover in the spotlight. So, again, thank you so much again for tuning in to this week's very special episode of Who Killed Amy Mahalovic. This is part one of my conversation with Nick and the Captain. Part two will be dropping next week. So again, as always, stay safe, and be healthy.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine, from history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts, and on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.